Blog Talk Radio.
Africa, the center of the world. Latitude zero, longitude zero. Planned by the Creator. Sesanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now, we give you Africa, the center of the world. So vast, so great, the African embrace, the color of life, universal harmony, the earth supports our conscious effort for sustained humanity, human beings. Human love on a spiritual tip, so vast, so great, the African embrace. Live beyond, love beyond your skin. To where you belong.
Started a long time ago, and it wasn't a show. We gave birth to a style like a precocious child, feeling the passion for life, erasing away all the strife. Telling our tales with verbal mail, putting honey on the blade, creating language to persuade. Share who we've always been. always a blessing, never a sin. We are doo-wop and bebop and hip-hop and we don't stop. Since our mother gave birth to everyone on earth, should we echo her call and always walk tall? Cause we're hip to the world, so we create black pearls that everyone can wear, that everyone can share. We can't live in despair, so we shine everywhere. On and on. On and on. On and on.
We're welcoming you to Africa on the Move. Today, this week on Africa on the Move, we have invited Love Professor India Tusi. She is a professor at the University of Indiana. She just published a new book titled Policing Bodies, Law, Sex, Work, and Desire in Johannesburg. We'll be speaking to her very shortly. After, like always, when we introduce our political panelists and analysts for today's show. This is Africa on the Move. I'm your host, Brother Africa. As you know, the way we get started with our party is to introduce to you our political panelists and analysts for the day, followed by our guests. And like always, we will speak truth to the powerless and the powerful. So let's get started with our party, and we'll bring in our first political panelist for today. Brother Haki, we'd like to welcome you to Africa on the Move. Welcome, Brother Haki.
Brother Africa, thanks for having me. My name is Haki Kamathi Mashoki. Currently, I'm with African Awareness, and of course, you know, my thing is institution building. But when we talk about institution building, one of the things that's so important is that it provides a certain amount of clarity in terms of the political situation we find ourselves confronted with. You know, recently there was this killing of this young brother, Amir Locke, in Minnesota. And interestingly enough, the community came out, and I was very impressed with the community in the sense that, you know, they pretty much deconstructed the narrative established by the state, which tend to indicate or at least support the idea that Amir Locke is somehow instrumental in his own killing. So clearly, his tendency in terms of, you know, creating a narrative which says that the victims are always responsible for their deaths is quite impossible how these institutions operate. And the fact that people were aware of that speaks to a growing awareness in society in terms of, these institutions that have adverse impact on the overall functioning, you know, of those societies. So clearly, Brother Africa, I'm very, very pleased in terms of the community's response in terms of Amir's Locke case. And it's one of those cases I think the nation as at large should follow very, very closely. And as always, Brother Africa, again, I want to thank you for having me.
Thank you, Brother Haki. Next, we will bring in Brother Anthony, and we would like to welcome him to Africa on the Move. Welcome, Brother Anthony.
Thanks for having me, Brother Africa. Revolutionary greetings to you, the fellow panelists, our special guest, and the listening audience. My name is Anthony Williams. I'm an organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC. Objective is Pan-Africanism, the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism.
Fine, Brother Anthony. We will now bring you Brother Moses, and we'd like to welcome him to Africa on the Move. Welcome, Brother Moses.
Thank you, Brother Africa, and greetings to everyone within the sound of my voice, especially the illustrious panelists. My name is Robert Andrew Moses. I've been in the struggle for scientific socialism from the moment I was introduced to Marxism during the government class back in my high school years, 1968. I call Marxism the race to cure racism. I bear witness that there's one God, Jesus, who is the author and finisher of my faith, and that Mao Zedong is his messenger for government. Fathers, help your children. And we don't reverse correct verdicts. I'm pro-choice, and I vote. And women hold up half the sky. That's why I support the Equal Rights Amendment, ERA, yes. And it continues to be a struggle to unite the many, to defeat the few, to show that the interests of the vast majority of the people diametrically and antagonistically opposed to the interests of the 1%. And it's our duty to explain that to the people. Thank you, Brother Africa, for allowing me to be on the show.
It's an honor, Brother Moses, and we make our transition to Sister Eleanor. We will welcome her to welcome to Africa on the Move, Sister Eleanor.
Thank you so much, Brother Africa. And my name is Eleanor Johnson. And thank you to my fellow panelists and our listening audience, and to you, Brother Africa. That is a wonderful statement, Brother Haki mentioned Amir Locken. We've seen the video or the police cam of his assassination, and this just continues to be what's going on in America, and hopefully we'll see changes soon. Also, Brother Africa, I want to congratulate Senegal for winning the African Cup. That's the soccer cup. They won against Egypt. Egypt was up for its 8th win, and Senegal ended up winning in overtime. I think the score was 4-2. So congratulations to the people of Senegal. It was a magnificent time for the people of Senegal, I understand. The game was over at 11 p.m. in Senegal, and everyone from the grandmothers to the babies came out in praise, and everywhere you saw the Senegalese red, yellow, and green flags flying high and proud. So congratulations to the football team of Senegal winning the African Cup. Thank you, Brother Africa.
Thank you, Sister Eleanor. And last and not least, we'll bring in Brother Maurice, and we will welcome him to Africa on the Move. Welcome, Brother Maurice.
Greetings, Brother Africa, and thank you for having me here again tonight. I know it's been a while. I'm happy to be back on the show. Again, my name is Brother Maurice. I'm a member of SLANG, Struggling, Living, and Never Giving Up, and I'm also a member of PRSP, Pan-African Revolutionary Socialist Party. And moreover, I'm a worker of the people. But thank you for having me here tonight, brother.
Thank you for being here, Brother Maurice. And to our listening audience, theme tonight is Policing Bodies, Lost Sex Work and Desires in Johannesburg. That's the title of a book that was written by this young lady, who is our special guest. We're going to bring in the law professor, our sister Inia Tusi. We're going to bring her in, and we're going to ask her to introduce herself to you. She is a very accomplished young lady, and we want her to share some of her accomplishments. So, Sister Tusi, how would you describe who you are and share some of your accomplishments with our listening audience?
Thank you, Brother Mike. First, I want to thank you for having me on the show, and thank you to the panelists and the listening audience. I'm India Tusi. I'm a professor of law at Indiana University Maurer School of Law. I'm also a senior scientist at the Kinsey Institute, and I teach critical race theory, criminal procedure, and criminal law. My research focuses on the policing and criminalization of racial and sexual hierarchies, and I have a new book out about the policing of sex work in Johannesburg, South Africa. And so this topic about, you know, what's been happening with policing and whether police actually play a role of providing protection versus violence in society is one that I've been focused on through the years. I did PhD research kind of focused on that topic. And so I'm really looking forward to our conversation this evening, how the insights from Africa can also provide a way for us to think about policing in the U.S. as well.
You know, Sister India, one of the things I also found out about you that you have an interesting career in terms of your travel, your liveabouts. It's my understanding that you were born in Nigeria and you end up going to school in America as well as in South Africa. Can you explain that journey, what your background had been like in terms of your experiences of being a young lady born in Nigeria, end up living in America and being given the opportunity to go back to Africa and go to school in Johannesburg, what that whole struggle has been about or been like?
Sure. Sure. So I was born in Nigeria, but came to the U.S. when I was maybe around 3 or maybe 5 months old. I was just a baby. And so I had no real memory of it. And, you know, and I guess I was, you know, grew up believing myself to be, you know, an American, although I know I had this heritage in Nigeria and this connection there and family there. I only went back when I was 5 years old, and then thereafter when I was about 19. So I didn't visit frequently. And so I had this connection to the continent of Africa. And, you know, I was interested in what was happening there. I was connected, you know, just from my heritage as, you know, all Black people through diaspora are. And so when I went into law school, I knew I was interested in being a civil rights lawyer and doing human rights work. And while I was in law school, I had an opportunity to be part of this program, the Crowley Program for International Human Rights, that allows law students, a small group of law students who are selected for the program, get to travel to a different location and do a fact-finding human rights mission. And so the year that I was selected to do the program, the mission was in South Africa. And when I went to South Africa as part of this human rights mission, we were looking at gender rights and how customary law was impacting women in South Africa. I knew I wanted to go back to this country. It was just an exciting time to be there. The constitution in South Africa actually is pretty progressive and embraces human rights, which is actually quite different from the constitution in the United States in the ways that the Supreme Court has interpreted the duties of government officials in the United States. So I wanted to go somewhere where there was this open embrace of human rights principles and norms within the domestic system. And so I knew I wanted to go back to South Africa. And, you know, a few years after I graduated from law school, I applied for a clerkship with the Constitutional Court of South Africa. So that's their highest court, kind of like our Supreme Court. And I got the clerkship. I worked there for several months and decided I want to stay longer and began my PhD studies and did research on policing in South Africa, focusing on sex work. And so, you know, that's how, I guess, personally and professionally, my journey has taken me, you know, across through the U.S. and into South Africa with this general interest in human rights norms.
You know, having the chance to live in Zambia, South Africa, and going to school in Johannesburg, from your own observation and experiences of living there, how would you categorize the objective conditions of the indigenous people, the Africans, in that area in terms of when you're talking about human rights and social justice? You have had a chance to go there, see the people, live among them. What was the findings that you found in terms of the question of the social, political conditions of the African people back home in that country?
Yeah, so South Africa is an interesting place to focus on. First, you know, like many parts of Africa, there's this history of colonialism, right? And there's settler colonialism in South Africa with, you know, Dutch and both British people settling in South Africa. And you also have a history of racial apartheid, right? That was, you know, part of South African history for, you know, around 100 years. And so, you know, in many ways it has this connection to the U.S., actually, in terms of this legalized separation of people because of their racial identity. And so the people who are indigenous to South Africa as part of, or really before apartheid, but as it was starting to gear up around the 1940s, but starting in the early 1900s and late 1800s, you had indigenous people being dispossessed of their land in South Africa. And so, you know, the justification for the dispossession, similar to the U.S., was that, you know, they weren't using the land properly and that the white settlers would be, you know, more appropriate holders of this land, even though they were indigenous to the land. Now, coming forward to contemporary South Africa, what's interesting, although apartheid ended in the 1990s, and there was, after the fall of apartheid and Nelson Mandela was president, there was this embrace of, we're going to bring human rights into our system, we're going to focus on truth and reconciliation, and we're going to have a process where we're going to also recognize socioeconomic rights. So the Constitution of South Africa recognizes a right to housing, recognizes a right to education, which we don't even have in the United States. However, given the legacy of South Africa, what you find is that, you know, a lot of government officials openly embrace human rights norms, they'll use human rights language. However, the material conditions of many of the people who are indigenous to South Africa are not at the same level as those of the white settlers. And so there is still continued racial inequality in terms of socioeconomic status in South Africa. So that's something that you still see. Something else that you'll see when you go to South Africa, there is this growing and burgeoning black middle class there and black upper class in South Africa, but there is great economic inequality. And so I think this is, you know, part of that legacy of racial apartheid. Like, even when you embrace human rights norms, it becomes really difficult to change the material conditions of people who have been impacted by racial apartheid. And, you know, it really kind of demonstrates where you have a very exploitive economic conditions that, you know, it's really difficult to fully ensure that people receive the reparations that are due to them. And so, you know, if you go to South Africa now, I think you notice, well, Johannesburg in particular, as a, you know, it's an exciting area. You'll notice that there are a lot of black middle-class people. You'll notice that it's, you know, very developed community and area. And, you know, in some ways it will be quite similar and comfortable for people coming from the U.S. But at the same time, you might also notice that there's spatial segregation, that, you know, a lot of the people in the lower classes in Johannesburg are going to be black people. You might notice in some of the more upper-end communities that there are, might be more white people, maybe even predominantly white people. And I think that kind of really demonstrates the continued legacy of apartheid in South Africa.
And India, another accolade that you can just briefly share with the listening audience, I recognize you also had the opportunity to work with the National Lawyer Guild as it relates to human rights issues and concerns. What did you learn while working with the institution, and how did the institution have an impact on your continuation of working in this area of human rights, if any?
Sure. So I've been affiliated with the National Lawyers Guild, and really the nature of my involvement with the National Lawyers Guild has been serving as, a watcher during different protests, and that was something that I was pretty active with in the past couple of years. I think, you know, maybe starting from the protests in protest to George Floyd's murder and also Breonna Taylor's murder. And so, you know, I would observe, you know, the police during these encounters with protesters, and that was my involvement with the National Lawyers Guild, and just really serving as legal protection, a legal observer during these different protests. But, you know, I started off my legal career at the American Civil Liberties Union, and there I worked as a civil rights lawyer. I was part of the racial justice program and focused on issues around the school-to-prison pipeline, policing in schools, the ways that young people are being criminalized in our school system. And, you know, that experience, you know, exposed me to other lawyers doing this type of work and organizers doing this type of work. But also, you know, just the harms that come when we focus on police and the criminal system to address, you know, marginalized communities.
Okay, to our listening audience, this is Africa on the Move. We're discussing the theme tonight, policing bodies, law, sex work, desire in Johannesburg. We have special guest, Sister India Tusi. What we're going to do right now, we're going to take a station break, and when we come back, we're going to have a discussion on her upcoming book. And we want you to stay tuned. Don't you go nowhere. This is Africa on the Move.
Buffalo soldier, dread like a rasta. It was a buffalo soldier in the heart of America, stolen from Africa, brought to America.
Right, welcome back to Africa on the Move. We're fighting upon our rival, and we are still fighting for our survival. We're speaking with our sister India Tusi. She's going to be discussing with us about her new book, Policing Bodies. Right now, we'd like to welcome her back. And Sister India, what I would like to do before we go into your book real quickly is having a background in the area of understanding human rights. Many times our people don't know the difference between human rights and civil rights. Can you give us a distinction of what human rights are and how they're different from civil rights? And based upon your travel, we always equate this violation of human rights with countries outside the U.S. What's your understanding of the nature of human rights or the lack of it as it relates to the reality of living in the United States?
Sure. So I guess when people speak of human rights, oftentimes think of it as being something that involves like international standards. It might be something that comes from what the United Nations has proclaimed. I think human rights are rights that are just, you know, kind of innate to us just being individuals, people, and, you know, rights that people cannot take away from us, right? So something like the right to life could be conceptualized as a human right. And then often when people speak about civil rights, it might be those political rights that are particular to the system that you live within. So often they think about them domestically, so civil rights within U.S. context. So maybe like our right to vote and to fully participate within a society. However, I tend to think of human rights and civil rights often are the same things, right? And so maybe human rights might allow for a bigger umbrella for thinking about civil rights, right? And so our civil rights are also, I believe, you know, our human rights as well. So our right to participate in the society that we're in and that is governing our everyday life is also a human right, I believe. And I think human rights standards also play a role domestically, right? And so when you're speaking about something like, for example, a situation where there's police violence that is run rampant in particular communities, you know, you can describe it as a civil rights violation. I think you could also describe it as human rights violations, that the police in those communities are violating people's human rights, their basic, you know, right to live as human beings with dignity, right? And so, you know, the terms, I think, have different lineages, but I do think that they get to a lot of the, in some ways, human rights might allow for a broader conception of the rights that we're entitled to as people within a society.
This is India. Let's go to the question of the discussion tonight, which is we want to take a look at your book, your new book that you just released, Policing Bodies, Law, Sex Work, and Desire in Johannesburg. How you came up with this title and what's the audience that you were appealing to and what is the message that you want to bring to that particular audience as relates to reading your book and having your book available for those who want to read it?
Sure. And so the book is about the policing of sex work in Johannesburg. And it provides insights about what role police should play in a society, particularly when you're dealing with marginalized communities. And so this book really discusses issues around gender and how that played into the police's approach to sex workers. It discusses different topics around feminism and intersectionality and how feminists should perhaps re-examine the reliance on police and the criminal system when dealing with marginalized communities. And then I think it provides insights just about race and policing and that the police approach their policing to different sex workers based on their perceptions on where they lied within the racial hierarchy, where lighter-skinned sex workers received more benevolent policing and darker-skinned sex workers were subjected to more aggressive forms of policing or ignored. And I think it provides insights that, you know, apply within the South African context, but also in the context of the United States, because there can be this tendency to think of Africa as this distant elsewhere, something outside. But I think the insights from Africa are relevant to how we think about policy and policing here. And so the title Policing Bodies, in some way is reflecting the ways that the police were approaching the different groups of sex workers, where they were reducing them just to their bodily status and taking different approaches to how they were policing them based on where they fit into the racial and sexual hierarchy. And so the book is an ethnography, which meant I spent time working with police, working as their police partner as they were policing these different classes of sex workers in these three different communities that I focused on, but also working with sex workers, which is what makes this book really unique, that I was able to get access to officially work with a police organization, which could be really difficult, and at the same time also get access to work with sex workers who are being policed by these same police officers. And so I was working with both groups at the same time, which, you know, brings some complexities and nuances to the book. And so I focused the title on, you know, policing bodies to reflect the different approaches to policing, these different categories of sex workers, and law, sex worker, and desire just gives, you know, a little bit more insight about, you know, the things that I saw during the course of my ethnography, right? Their ways that they interpreted the law. They were focusing on sex work, but their own desires and their own perceptions of desires influenced how they were policing different groups of sex workers.
You know, in terms of if you had to make a distinction or a difference between being a sex worker versus being a prostitute as a woman, how would you respond to that?
Well, the term sex worker was coined, I believe it was the 1970s or so, to kind of really encapsulate the fact that what was happening, the people were engaging in a form of labor, bodily labor, and it was to try to move away from the stigma that can come from the term prostitute, right? And so actually during the course of my research, when I was speaking with the police, I actually did use the word prostitute, because when I used the word sex worker, a word that they didn't use, it was a distraction and, you know, it was difficult to explain to them. And so I did use that term. I mean, they are essentially referring to the same form of conduct and the same individuals. However, one term is really trying to move away from stigma and recognize the labor that people are engaging in and recognize that, you know, that term prostitute actually comes with a lot of baggage. When I was working with the sex workers, they would refer to themselves as, you know, sex workers, or sometimes they refer to themselves as just working ladies. But, you know, really emphasizing the fact that, you know, what they were doing is, you know, professional conduct, that they were engaging in the form of labor and, you know, deserve some respect while they're doing so.
Now, how does this question of human rights ties into this issue of this question of being a sex worker?
Interesting. Before I went into the field to do my research, the police in one of the communities that I focused on had actually been sued because they were accused of violating sex workers' human rights. And what was meant by this was that they were arresting sex workers, they were engaging in violence against the sex workers, they were profiling them, right? And so this is what, you know, the human rights violation they were accused of. By the time I went on the field, they had decided to take an approach where they would treat it as if it were fully decriminalized. And the aim was to respect the human rights of sex workers and to recognize that you have to protect everyone's human rights within South African society. And so they took this approach where they stopped arresting them. And that approach actually quickly changed to a different approach where they're arresting the sex worker clients. But during that period of time when they were arresting the clients, I found that it actually increased the amount of violence toward sex workers because the clients felt that the sex workers might be cooperating with the police. And the sex workers weren't able to fully screen their clients because their work had been criminalized and pushed underground. Now, the issues around human rights that come up when you're dealing with sex workers is that, you know, there's a question of what level of police intervention you should have and can you still protect sex workers' human rights depending on what level of intervention you have. what I observed is when you have more police intervention, so where you treat sex work as fully criminalized or even partially criminalized, it actually increases the human rights violations they were encountering. And so this is going back to my prior point about stigma and marginalization, because the more stigmatized sex workers are and the work that they're doing is, then the less they're able to screen clients, the less they're able to cooperate with each other, because at the same time they're doing their work, they're running from police, they're hiding away from police, or they're protecting their clients from police, and they're not able to fully engage in screening processes that would allow them to protect themselves, right? And so that ends up resulting in a situation where you have more human rights abuses against the sex workers. And so going back to something that was, you know, discussed a little bit earlier about the, you know, the killing of Amir Locke, I think is connected, right? Oftentimes people think about these topics as being disconnected, but I think that, you know, the ways that sex work is actually police provides insights for us to just think about policing more broadly, right? And what it shows is that, you know, the police here were purposely thinking about human rights. They're trying to protect the sex workers' human rights. But when they intervened, they created more precarity. It was a more fragile situation, and it resulted in more human rights violations against sex workers. Likewise, in the U.S., where you have communities that are heavily policed, heavily surveilled, often what you find is not protection from the police. You find violence from the police. And often when people are speaking about different crime rights of marginalized communities, they're not including the crimes that police are committing against the communities, the types of violence, the murders and the killings that they inflict upon those communities. Those are human rights violations. And I think it's important to kind of think about both the harm that comes from policing, not just the harm that lies within the community. And I think to start thinking about other ways to deal with harm in the communities, in marginalized communities in particular.
You know, in terms of legitimizing this concept of sex workers, from your interactions with other women inside of Zambia, South Africa, and throughout the world, when you mentioned the term sex workers, what has been the opinion of women in general? How do they see this concept of sex workers? Do they is there a big stigma still today of seeing this as a form of illegitimate work? And on top of that, the reason why we have sex workers, most people say it may not necessarily be a choice by a woman, but they are forced because the way the society structure is forcing them to make, you know, these kind of choices out of economic survival.
Thank you for that question. I think, you know, sex workers are still facing an incredible amount of stigma and marginalization, and a lot of that comes from women groups, that comes from feminist groups at times, where, you know, they are being categorized as, you know, in really kind of broad strokes and not really allowed to have any individual autonomy and make individual choices. And so, you know, what I've found from my research pretty interesting is that, you know, some of the groups that have been advocating for criminalization or partial criminalization of sex work, right, have been feminist groups. Now, to be clear, sex worker advocacy groups, groups where there are sex workers involved who are doing the advocacy, often, almost always, advocate for decriminalization, and they advocate for decriminalization that way it can eliminate some of the risky situations they might find themselves in. It might allow them to properly screen, right? It might allow them to seek resources or be honest with their healthcare providers, not for fear that they might be criminalized and perhaps, you know, thrown into jail or lose custody of their children, things that happen when people come out as sex workers. Right. But despite this, you know, there have been feminist groups that have called for the criminalization of sex work. And part of the rationale some of them use is say, well, we need to save the sex worker from themselves, that women should engage in this type of labor, and therefore we must criminalize the conduct. Now, part of what my issue with this argument is that relying on the criminal system, relying on policing to protect any class of women, but particularly women who deal with intersectional forms of discrimination, right? So Black women, immigrant women, women with disabilities, these are the classes of women that often face violence at the hands of police. They're often situations where these same women, if they call the police, for example, to report a domestic partner because of domestic violence, they end up being arrested, right? Or they end up losing their children because, you know, someone may accuse them of creating unsafe conditions. So these are women who are also facing vulnerability at the criminal system. So I don't think the answer will ever be to rely on that same criminal system to somehow save them from themselves. I think it's important to now move the conversation past criminalization and start to think about how can we support women so they can make choices that they want to make. How can we create material conditions that acknowledge people's different circumstances, but still provide for them? How can we focus on that instead of focusing on more police, more criminalization? Because more police, more criminalization only assures that Black women, women who are facing different forms of marginalization are going to be caught into that system, right? So they're going to face the harms that led to them perhaps entering into work that maybe they want to enter into, and then also the harms in the criminal system. And so I think that's really problematic. And so part of my issue is this over-reliance on policing and criminalization has actually created a lot of harms for marginalized communities. And that's what I'm hoping people get from reading this book, is that we rely too heavily on police. And when we start to pull back our reliance from police and think about other ways to support communities and support people's material needs, that in fact that also enhances safety, that also enhances the conditions people are living under.
You know, Sister Emmy, other folks also will make the argument that this whole issue of sex workers is also an issue that goes back hundreds of thousands of years on men trying to define and have the right to control women in their bodies. Your response to that generalization?
Sure. You know, work has been something that has existed for a long time. There have been exploitative conditions in sex work. There have been exploitative conditions and a lot of type of labor. But for some reason in particular, you know, sex work is often targeted for, at least more recently has been targeted for criminalization and high-end policing. While sex work can have these situations that could be really difficult for the people who are engaged in sex work, it's also been a source of economic liberty for a lot of people, particularly a lot of women that I've interacted with. It could be a way for some of them to earn an income that otherwise would not be available to them, given the racist and sexist system that they were operating under, right? And so for some of the sex workers I did my research with, you know, there was one in particular that I'm thinking about. You know, she had worked as a domestic worker for some time and went out of that and went into sex work. And she said to me, you know, doing the work as a domestic worker, she was targeted with sexual harassment. The family that she was working with, she was in a precarious situation. She could be vulnerable to violence. But that type of work is allowed to continue, right? Domestic work can be very exploitive and demeaning, but that's allowed to continue because, you know, who's supported by it? Well, middle-class women are supported by it. It upholds, you know, a particular type of capitalist structure. But at the same time, she moved on from domestic worker and did sex work. And she said to me, you know, she was able to provide for her entire family. She was able to afford a lifestyle that otherwise she couldn't afford, given her educational background and the other opportunities available to her. And she tried other opportunities. The best work opportunity for her was available in sex work, right? And she was able to, you know, free her family in many ways. You know, she was able to help them in terms of their migration into South Africa and support her family members and support her children, right? And I think that's important. That's important to know because, you know, I think it's important that we, you know, support people and really ensure that they're having their needs met and their material conditions are being in such a way where they can have a dignified life. I think that's absolutely important. And, you know, I just don't think that we can do that by relying on police and the criminal system to provide a remedy. You know, when you think about other forms of labor, for example, someone working in a coal mine, right? I mentioned domestic work, even boxing, where people are putting their bodies out there. They can expose themselves to these exploited conditions. I think it's important to support those people and maybe create a situation where they don't need to exploit their bodies. But at the same time, I think it would be really foolish to criminalize that work that they're engaging in to support themselves in that moment. I think that would be, and I think that it's really unfortunate that that's the approach that has been taken with sex work.
Okay, we're going to one of our political panelists for today. We'll bring in Brother Hackey. Brother Hackey, we will now turn the mic over to you.
Thank you, Brother Africa. Let me ask the professor. I got three quick questions for her. But the first one is, you know, is relatively straightforward. But the thing is that one of the things that I find ironic is that when you talk about the economy in terms of the private and public sphere, with respect to the question of sex work, it seems to me that those systems, whether it be economic, political, social, are well-defined. And so it seems to me that the question in terms of one's right in terms of self-actualized or to be or to engage in activity which is beneficial to the self seems to me shouldn't be a question at all. But one of the things, the question I want to ask you, though, Professor, is this. Now, what role does capitalism play in blurring the line between public and private sphere functioning? Now, even though capitalism exposes individual rights, what could be more individual than adults agreeing upon sexual relations privately? It is not a contract like the agreements between up echelon and police departments in Johannesburg and establishment owners promoting sex work? Your response.
Thank you. That is an excellent question. And I think it really illustrates some of the hypocrisy here, right? And, you know, what you're really pointing out is the fact that, you know, under capitalism, there's supposed to be this kind of really upholding of individual rights and allowing for a free market. But here we have this situation where we have these private encounters being regulated or really prohibited. And it seems to run counter of some of the intuitions that one might have about what capitalism is supposed to do. And, you know, the only way I can really make sense of it or try to interpret why we have this, this situation that doesn't fully align with the norms of capitalism is really patriarchy, right? The fact that, you know, sex work in many ways throughout time has been a way that women who have been unfree have freed themselves, right? Whether free themselves economically and engaged in a type of work that doesn't require that they be, directly controlled necessarily by a man. And, you know, there have been these stories where, for example, even female slaves have been able to buy their freedom through the work they were doing while engaged in sex work, while they weren't doing, what they were doing as slaves. And so, you know, I think, you know, part of the thing that makes sex work distinct is that it has been this way that women in particular have been able to, you know, engage in economic labor and, you know, free themselves and earn incomes that, you know, otherwise wouldn't be available to them. And, you know, and that's maybe can be threatening to certain capitalist societies or patriarchal societies. I think, you know, that may explain, you know, in part why it's been criminalized. But I think there's also some additional complexity there because, you know, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, why has it been so much activism from feminist groups that have opposed sex work? You know, in what ways is sex work, you know, a threat to maybe middle-class women or certain classes of, you know, middle-class women? And that's a kind of a difficult thing that I'm still kind of thinking through and don't have a clear answer on, but I think that's part of the equation too. And part of, you know, understanding why, you know, sex work has been criminalized in so many societies, despite the fact that, you know, criminalization has been, you know, ineffective, right? And actually criminalization in many societies is a relatively recent thing, you know, something that's happened in the past, you know, within the past century. It's not something that necessarily existed prior to that. So I think, you know, you're pointing to a really important question that, you know, that highlights some of the inconsistencies that you can see with capitalism. But I think, you know, when you factor in the fact that we live in a patriarchal society, that South Africa is a patriarchal society, it might give some insights to, you know, why that inconsistency is there.
Okay, Professor, my second question. Now, in assessing the competing police strategies on sex workers in Johannesburg, it appears sex work is tolerated provided the beneficiaries of sex work are brothels and private residents, presumably owned by men. Now, might this account for the tendency of police policy to view sex work more negatively in poor neighborhoods because of the prevalence of women as independent contractors?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I think you're going to a really important insight that, you know, so what I found during my research was that in those areas where the men were actually benefiting primarily from sex work, you know, indirectly through these, you know, hotel brothels that they owned and were running, that there was this relationship with the police and there was more respect for the sex work in those locations. Whereas when women were independent contractors, there was more surveillance and more control of the women engaged in this labor. Yes, and I absolutely agree with you that that could be part of the reason why you have this distinction in these different locations. And that's a really important insight.
Okay, my final question, Professor. Now, you alluded to in your book the cultural imperative where many police officers view sex workers as dirty, in part resulting from society's ethos that justifies male masculinity and the license to publicly discipline dirty women. Now, my question to you, Professor, at what point does the humiliation of women ceases to enjoy cultural relevance and gain a newfound political understanding of the socioeconomic challenges many women are confronted? Or am I simply asking too much?
Well, I don't think you're asking for too much. That's something that I would love to see, right, where we can have respect for all women and respect everyone's dignity. Are we there in any society right now? I'm not sure. When will we be there? I'm not sure. But I think it's important to still make that demand and say that that's where our vision should be and what we should be aiming for, right? That, you know, respecting everyone's dignity, regardless of their socioeconomic status, and is you know, something that we should be doing as a society. And we certainly shouldn't be tolerating people, you know, be subjected to like humiliation and harassment because of that. And so, you know, I don't think it's too much to ask for. I think it's what we should be asking for, or at least striving toward. We're certainly not there yet, though.
Thank you, Professor.
Next, we'll make our transition to Brother Anthony. The mic is yours.
Thanks. Let's see. I found this work very interesting. My question to you relates to based upon your studies in South Africa and your working in the U.S., how do you find that these are both settler colonies? How do you find their attitudes toward sex workers similar and or different? You're talking about similar settler colonial situations.
Right. So I think the attitudes and history toward sex work is actually pretty similar. I think that can partially be explained because of the British influence in both the U.S. and in South Africa. And so, you know, in South Africa, what you had was that, you know, initially sex work was largely tolerated and treated as this necessary evil, but around the Victorian era is where you find heightened kind of scrutiny of sex work, heightened policing, and then eventually you'll find that there was criminalization. And you see a similar thing that happens in the U.S., right, because we're also influenced by the Victorian era and also influenced by the Progressive era in the U.S., and, you know, you have in the mid-1900s, or really the early 1900s, where you find that sex work starts to be criminalized, both in South Africa and in the United States. And so I think those, you know, part of what was driving the focus on sex work during the Victorian era was the sense that, you know, it's undignified labor, it's going to be harmful for women, and so we need to criminalize it and kind of, you know, focus on our sexual morality. And that was part of the rationale. And as a result of that, you know, you see this in the U.S., you see it in South Africa, you also see it in India and, you know, a number of British colonies, this, you know, move from just treating sex work as something that was inevitable and that would be there to trying to criminalize and kind of outlaw it or prevent it from occurring. And so, you know, both – and so I think it's going to your question about how the settler colonial history impacts the perspective on sex work. I think right there, the fact that there is this tie to what's happening in England is pretty significant, and it has this, it really created this situation where there are these parallels in terms of what was happening at the same time, and where, you know, the during the Victoria era, where there was this real push to get, you know, the British colonies to adapt certain approaches, or even the former colony to adapt certain approaches toward prostitution and toward sex work. And so I think in both places there was this, you know, marginalization and stigma attached to sex work. And, you know, in both places, in both the United States and South Africa, you know, the sex workers are dealing with, you know, heightened policing and surveillance. And so, you know, I think that that makes for an interesting comparison. You know, something else, though, that I think that makes the South African and U.S. example particularly interesting is that because they both have racial apartheid, you see these ideas around race also come in into the ways that people are perceiving sex workers, right? And so what I observed in South Africa was that, you know, whiter or lighter skinned sex workers being more respected by the police, darker skinned, blacker sex workers being more disrespected by the police. And you see the same thing in the United States in terms of, you know, where you have black people, black women, black trans people just being targeted for policing as, on suspicion of being sex workers in ways that you don't have that same heightened policing for white sex workers, or, you know, white women being suspected of just being sex workers because they're in public spaces. And so, you know, that shared settler colonial history creates these different parallels, as well as that shared, you know, racial apartheid.
Now, since South Africa, unlike the U.S., has adopted human rights as a part of its policy, has that helped sex workers in South Africa much in terms of removing the stigma of sex work, or has it, or is it too early in your view to tell, what, since this is a recent development, to tell whether that's may have much of an impact or not?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. I think, I guess maybe it is a bit early. I mean, I think it might provide some basis, like in terms of the types of arguments you might make and the fact that you can cite to human rights, but has it really changed people's conditions? I mean, I can't say that it has. And, you know, what that kind of suggests, you know, might give some insights in the context of the U.S. is that just saying that we're going to change certain norms or use different types of language doesn't necessarily change the type of policing you're going to have, right? And so even with the police, they switched their name from South African Police to South African Police Service to demonstrate that they would now serve the South African people after apartheid, right? So really deliberately moving away from their apartheid history. They have a human rights manual where they're embracing these human rights norms. Yet, despite that, you still have racialized policing in South Africa. And what's interesting in South Africa it's mostly black officers who are in the police force. Now, I think that's an important insight because, you know, in the U.S., there are some arguments that if we diversify the police force, that'll change policing and we'll have, you know, be able to deal with all our problems with policing. However, if you look at the context of South Africa, it suggests that even if you have black officers, if you're operating within a white supremacist society, that, you know, you're just going to have black officers engaged in white supremacist policing, at least from a systemic level, right? Because if it's to maintain the existing social and racial hierarchies, well, that's still going to be there, right? And so it really forces us to really examine, well, what is policing, right? Can policing really serve us in the way that we're thinking that it's intended to serve us? And it can, you know, really lead to more fundamental questions. So, you know, while South Africa has embraced these human rights norms and the South African police have embraced these human rights norms, I think it illustrates that, you know, even if you embrace these norms, that there are some things fundamental to policing, right? Having the armed agents of the state who are intending to maintain existing hierarchies forced to interact with marginalized communities. I think there's fundamental issues about policing that just can't be eradicated, even if the U.S. were to embrace human rights.
I think you make some good points, and that brings me to a final question. To what extent do you think the economic system that dominates these societies play a role in terms of even how sex work is looked at in these two societies? They're both capitalist societies, and I think that's the common thread, that you have an economic system that oppresses the overwhelming majority of the workers. And to what extent does that, and in which there's a stigma associated with sex work? And to what extent do you think is that plays a factor in the problem, in the fact that that the police, regardless of their ethnicity, have some attitudes because of their job function within these societies?
I think that's absolutely relevant, right? The fact that, you know, we're speaking about both of these, you know, countries. We're talking about countries that embrace, you know, capitalism, right? And then the police are really just there to kind of protect these hierarchies that exist within this capitalist society. And I think that's, you know, an important insight that, you know, to some extent, what I was observing, what I've been observing are the probably issues that are connected to these just capitalist structure, right, and the exploitation that allows for the fact that there is this inequality that's built into the structure, that you have people who are going to be, you know, the losers within the capitalist system, you know, often people who are workers, right, and then the police are really, you know, intended to protect the property interest, to protect property, right, which are going to be those people who are, you know, oftentimes exploiting the labor of the workers. And so, you know, some of what, you know, I'm observing is really, you know, fundamental to what happens within a capitalist structure, and a capitalist structure that also, you know, is really a racial capitalist structure that, you know, and has, you know, white supremacy kind of embedded into the system.
Thank you, Professor.
Thank you, Anthony. Right now, what we're going to do is you're listening to Africa on the Move. Take a rubbishing break. When we come back, we will continue the discussion with Law Professor Inya Tusi. And when we come back, we'll start off with our sister Eleanor. She'll be given the chance to have a dialogue with our sister. But before we go on our break real quickly, we would like to remind you, if you have not received or purchased your book yet, as relates to supporting our brother Bob Brown, please do so, and you can do that by going to the website www.a-aprp.gc.org. It's from the Pan-African Youth Publishers, Volume 1 and 2, which the book is titled, We Demand the Full Disclosure and Dignitization of All Slavery-Era Records. It's an excellent book, volume 1 and 2. It'll make a good present for Black History Month. Go and make sure you check out the website and get that book and support our brother Bob Brown. As well as, if you're still thinking about going on this free ride trip to Cuba with this organization and the African Awareness Association, we invite you to come and join us. We'll be visiting three provinces. That's Guantanamo, Santiago, and Havana, which is the capital of Cuba, from July 23rd to July 31st. If you're interested, please give us a call at 804-529-7492 or 802-714-9435, or check out the website. Africa Awareness Association website is www.aaa-cuba.com. Then we'll be talking about another alternative, how a society can organize itself for the betterment of mankind. Cuba is the place you want to be at. You want to see for yourself. Check out and meet your brothers and sisters. So those are our brief announcements. We're going to our station break. And when we come back, we will continue the discussion. Policing bodies, law, sex work, and desire in Johannesburg.
chains, living in pain. Today is the same, and nothing ever changes. Hung by a noose, can't tell the truth, filled with abuse, and everywhere there's danger. How long can this go on? When will the light I see? I know I must be strong to last through my journey, yes, to last through my journey, yes. Time will arrive when we must decide to get off the ride and stop going through these changes. We must prepare and learn how to care, for soon we'll be there where our lives won't be in danger. And when the light is clear, oh how beautiful I will be to know that I've been here and made it through my journey, yeah, and made it through my journey, yeah, 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 made it through my journey, made it through my journey.
Pellerino. A bloodline across the waters, from Benin to Salvador Bahia. A scar across the face of the earth. Pellerino, the place they brought the Africans, the place where they tried to make them slaves. Pellerino! You can feel the whip, hear the cries, and see the blood in the red clay. The clay that holds the stones together is African. And each stone is a bone from a people called slaves. Pellerino was the place where death came to dwell. His neighbors did not complain, for he was a way out. From the cold gray cobblestone streets to the lifeless cathedrals, tall walls of demons called angels, haunted visions of white faces crucifying Jesus again and again. But in the sacrifice of this blood, of this dance with death, comes life more rich, more pure, more alive, where death spent many lonely nights pacing the floors of his funeral parlor, waiting for someone to die. Pellerino, a French word called the place of torture, became a place of strength, a place where faces of white saints became faces of black gods, where haunted visions and demons became healing visionaries and orishas from the motherland. And Jesus rejoined his kinfolk and was reborn and baptized in the sound of sensual skin turned up to dance, to inspire a fire like the sun pronouncing his presence. Pellerino was the tongue of the flame, licking the eyes of those who have tried to remain blind, shining a light on a spirit that would not be denied. No, the chains did not break the spirit, did not enslave the music of my soul, did not shackle the will of my freedom, did not tarnish the glow of my gold. And all the Pellerinos in Africa, in Europe, in North and South America cannot destroy the majesty of my people, the love of my people, shining like the sun everywhere we go. Everywhere we go. When the light is clear, oh, how beautiful I will be to know that I've been here and made it through my journey, yeah, and made it through my journey, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah.
We'd like to welcome you back to Africa on the Move. If we had all the money in the world, I would give it to the people. Welcome back. Welcome back. We will continue our discussion. Policing Bodies, Law, Sex, Work, and Desire with Professor Enya Tusi. Right now, what we're going to do is let our listening audience know that if you have any views or comments, feel free to call in at 323-679-0841. Hit 1, and we will acknowledge your last four numbers. Sister Enya, before we go any further, I would like for you to share with our listening audience, how can they purchase a copy of your book for those who would like to purchase a copy?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. For people interested in purchasing a copy of my book, Policing Bodies, you can find it in any of your preferred booksellers. I encourage you to look at independent booksellers. One bookseller in particular, Burdock Book Collective, is an intersectional feminist bookstore based in Alabama, so that could be a source to buy the book online or any other, you know, preferred seller that you have for your books.
And also, with all of the wealth of knowledge you have accumulated, do you do any kind of speaking, gaming, workshops on various issues and topics where communities and organizations may would like to invite you?
Sure. People can feel free to reach out to me. My contact is on my university website page and also on my personal website page. So you can contact me by sending me an email, and I write and talk about policing, race, feminism, gender, sex work. So those are broad topics that I talk and write about and have different articles on these various topics.
Now, you happen to know your website page for your university or a email where you can leave with the audience so they know directly how to reach you?
Sure. So my email is itusi, so that's I-T-H-U-S-I at indiana.edu. So you can send me a direct email there. And if you do a Google search for me, India Tusi, Indiana, a couple of my faculty pages come up.
All right, thank you. So we're in the seat. We're going to take the heat. As we define it, we're going to stand behind it. On that note, we're going to bring in our sister Eleanor. Sister Eleanor, the mic is yours.
Good evening, Dr. Tusi. My name is Eleanor Johnson, and I found the reading interesting. I see where you discussed the India, the Dutch East Indies country company from 1652, and its conception of sexuality, and that it was believed that the sailors needed the diversion of women workers, and how did the East Indies Company deal with that in 1652? I see that in all the colonies they seem to have brothels that closed at 9 o'clock. How were those slaves paid, or were they paid?
Right. So for the Dutch East Indies Company, for the early sex work in South Africa, it was mostly just tolerated. It wasn't criminalized or prohibited from occurring. So it did occur. And part of the reason why it was tolerated is that, you know, there was this sense that where you have this gender disparity in the colonies early on, and, you know, the sense that you need to at least allow for or at least tolerate sex work for the sailors who were now new and arriving in the colony. Now, in terms of the specific requirements and, you know, the nature of the people who are engaged in sex work, my understanding that, you know, in the Dutch East Indies Company, that the people who were primarily engaged in sex work, the women who were primarily engaged, were not enslaved. However, there were these, there was an account that I read about where someone was an enslaved woman, but they were also engaging in sex work, I guess, you know, somehow in off hours or, you know, maybe secretly, but they were engaging in sex work and they were able to buy their freedom from their captor, right? And so there were some slave present in the colony at that time. And there was a woman who was a slave woman who was able to buy her freedom from her slave master from the work that she was doing as a sex worker. And so I found that anecdote to be kind of an interesting one. But my understanding is that, you know, most of the people who are engaging in sex work, at least my understanding is that they were not, you know, enslaved individuals.
Well, I'm sorry. I was going from the book on where mm-hmm. you talked about the East Indies Company, and on page 23 where you talk about the slaves being forced into sex work, and how the oppressors saw that it was a way of increasing the slave population. So can you speak on that, please? Can you share?
Sure. Sure, absolutely. So, and I think, you know, you actually saw something similar in the United States as well, in terms of, you know, in slaves, people who were slave masters, you know, using their reproductive potential of the people that they have enslaved as a way for them to profit from. So either engaging in like rapes against the slave women as a way to increase the amount of people that they have enslaved, or, you know, otherwise find ways to exploit their bodies for their own economic potential. And so I think, you know, the passage that you're assigned to in your book is referencing, you know, one example where, you know, slaveholders were using, you know, enslaved women as a way to, you know, reproduce the amount of people that they had who were enslaved.
Yes, the Dutch East Indies Company and slavery is the section that I'm talking about. And all of these women were, in fact, enslaved, and it didn't seem that they earned any wages. Am I misinterpreting?
Yeah, you are. They did earn wages. The section is called the Dutch East India Company and Slavery.
Yes,
And it's mentioned. Yeah, and it mentions an example where there was someone who was enslaved who kind of bought their freedom, and so that's the connection that it was making towards slavery. But it wasn't, you know, intended to suggest that everyone who was engaged in sex work in this particular moment was enslaved, because they weren't.
Oh, it said that female slaves were always ready to offer their bodies for, you know, trite little things, and that the men had to leave the lodge by 9 p.m. So it didn't seem, and I didn't see where anyone was earning any wages, and they called them slaves, and by definition, I know in U.S. slave, but the point is, I was just trying to figure out, do you see the difference of the slaves under the early colonies in 1652, where there was sexual exploitation of women by the Dutch East Indies Company, and slavery, as the chapter was called, and the gold rush of South Africa? Are there any parallels or differences?
Sure. Sure, there's some differences. So just going back to the passage that you're referring to. So there were female slaves in the colonies. There was slavery that was present in the colonies. However, the sex work that was occurring was something separate, right? And so later on, in that same section, I mentioned how, you know, sex work was a mode for these women to transform their economic realities and provide an income that was higher than that could be earned through other opportunities, and that some of the female slaves who were present in the colonies were using sex work as a way to buy their freedom. And so that passage from Odo is just describing the perspective and the perceptions of the female slaves. However, you know, even despite that, female slaves were using sex work as a way to kind of buy their freedom. And there was even the crass example where, you know, this individual from that time is describing how the female sex slaves would say, you know, if you don't give me cash, then you're not going to get any sex for me, right? And so that's just kind of emphasizing the fact that they were using this as a way to just buy their freedom, which, you know, I think you see something similar happening during the gold rush. Now, what was interesting during the gold rush in Johannesburg, this is around a period of time where gold is discovered in Johannesburg in the Transvaal, and there was a lot of migration into the Johannesburg area. And then during this migration, people were, you know, engaging in mining. And so it was mostly men who were engaging in mining, but there were also women who were moving to the Transvaal area. And many of the women who were moving ended up engaging in sex work in order to earn an income once they entered into those Transvaal area, because they were closed off from any opportunities from engaging in mining themselves. And so, you know, you again see another situation where women using sex work as a way to find some economic liberty when their other options aren't available to them.
Thank you very much. I have one more question. Overall, do you think that under the East Indies Company that women were literally earning money and they weren't actually maybe earning money for the company itself? Because in your book, it states that the owners viewed it as a way of increasing its slave population, and they would bring the men to lodges where they would be free to roam until 9 p.m. And I just can't imagine that enslaved women were earning wages. Is there some valid research where that was the common norm, or was that just an exception?
Well, in this particular situation, so there's this one quote from someone who was part of the company slave lodge, right, Otto Mostel, and he's the same one who describes, you know, his perception of female slaves and that they would offer their body. And he claimed that the model of the slave sex worker was no cash, no sex, or, you know, to put it more crassly, to take the direct quote, it says no cash, no cunt, right, is what the phrase that he used to describe the female sex worker, and how sex workers were using this as a way to purchase their freedom. And said, you know, as part, during this period of time, there was this perception that these female sex workers were seeing sex work, I mean, these female slaves were seeing sex work as a way to buy themselves out of slavery, right? And so, you know, they, I mean, I think this is a really, you know, interesting part of history, perhaps not really known, where, you know, you have this situation where somehow, you know, female slaves were allowed to, you know, engage in sex work. Maybe it was because, you know, sex work was seen to be just this necessity, and that there wasn't a female population there, and they were able to earn the income from it and then use that income to buy themselves out of slavery. Now, I think that's really interesting. And whether the sense in which this is a distinct history, particular to the Dutch East Indies Company, or something present in other contexts, I'm not sure. I imagine there may be other contexts where, you know, you find a similar situation where women are forced into slavery, so they're slaves just, you know, engaged in other types of labor. But then, you know, finding, you know, going into sex work as a way to purchase their way out of slavery. So it was really something that was distinct from the work they were doing, you know, them being enslaved.
It must be unique to South Africa. Now, what is the correct pronunciation of this tribe, the Khoi? Khoi? How would you pronounce
Khoi?
That? You mentioned the Khoi, were the Khoi women, you know, in many cultures, women and men are seen as equal, as you discussed, not in British culture or European culture, is that a fact? And you go, but the Khoi in the early colonization of South Africa, they were active sex workers. So was the person who purchased their freedom or liberty a Khoi?
I'm not sure who the person that Otto Mansell was referring to in that particular passage. They may have been. There have been some references where I hear them refer to a slave person as being, you know, a colored female. If this person is a female slave, they perhaps could be someone who's enslaved coming from Europe, or it could be someone who was enslaved. The Khoi, my understanding of the history is that actually, you know, many of the Khoi people at that time were not enslaved. So I don't think that would, you know, the odds are that it probably wasn't a Khoi person. And then if there were examples of Khoi sex workers, they were just, you know, engaging in sex work, not necessarily as enslaved individuals.
Seeing that they were free, a free tribe. So do you think that I tend to think that sex work and in the East Indies, they the company, they seem to think that it was a necessary thing to prevent homosexuality among males. Do you think there's any validity to that?
Well, I mean, I don't think that's a valid rationale, but I think that they had that belief is, you know, that it was genuine that they believed that. I think that's probably true. You see examples of them making similar arguments in other British colonies where, you know, they have these sailors, these sailmen who are going to the different, you know, locations where the British Empire is expanding to, where they're colonizing. And, you know, there are these representations from the different, you know, captains as well as, you know, different officials from the British government saying that they have some concern about the sailors. You know, one of the concerns was that, you know, if they were going to engage in too much sex work, that there might be venereal disease. Another concern was that they needed to tolerate sex work or else there would be dealing with rampant, you know, homosexuality and, you know, expressing, you know, their disdain for that. And so you see, you know, there's evidence where this is being used as the argument to kind of tolerate sex work as this necessary evil at that period of time. But there were these concerns about having, you know, all of these single young men together to create, you know, some dangerous situations. And I think it's important to note, like, soon after, a little bit later on, you know, these concerns were really amplified during the Victorian era.
Yeah, I see during the Victorian era, there was also a belief, a double standard for sexuality amongst men and women that was perpetuated for what looks like 60 years. How do you think that impacted women and female equality?
Oh, I think it had a negative impact. I think it had a negative impact, right? And so there was this concern that, you know, around the Victorian era, there was a focus on sex workers and this idea that the sex workers were harmful individuals and that they were somehow violating sailors and that needed to protect the sailors from this, and it, this language is coming directly from the Contagious Diseases Act. You have to protect the sailors from the temptations of sex workers, right? And so there was this super surveillance of sex workers, forcing them to physical examinations that were painful against their will, and not the same focus on educating sailors. There wasn't that same focus on regulating the sailors' bodies, just focusing on the women's bodies and the, you know, sex workers as these temptresses. And I think you see these same double standards exist in society, right, where, you know, to a large extent there has been, you know, this tolerance of male, you know, sexual appetite. And then at times, you know, for women, they end up being really regulated or, you know, being, you know, really kind of penalized as being, you know, Jezebels and that sort of thing. You know, and I think, you know, younger generations, we're starting to see some of that, you know, a move away from that. We'll see if that's really sustained. But, you know, I think that's really been a part of culture in the U.S. and the culture in South Africa as well, this double standard.
And during your research in Hillsborough and Hillsborough, South Africa,
last question.
Did you run into many trans workers?
I actually did once. I mean, I didn't focus on trans sex workers, but I did actually encounter some trans sex workers. And what was interesting that I, so it was trans, black trans women sex workers that I encountered while I was doing my research. And what I had observed was that the police seemed very hostile towards the black women sex workers. And then the black women sex workers also seemed pretty empowered and emboldened in terms of, you know, how they spoke with the police and, you know, how deferential they were to the police. And the police that I saw encounter with them were, you know, had a very negative reaction in those moments. And so, but that was the extent of my observation of black trans sex workers. It's not something I focused on, but certainly something I'm thinking about focusing on in the future. And I think, you know, even with what's happening in the U.S. in terms of the ways that black women trans sex workers are kind of targeted and subjected to profile, I think it's definitely an area that deserves more attention.
Thank you so much, and thank you. I look forward to further discussion of your book. Thank you, Dr. Tassi.
Next, we go to Brother Maurice. The mic is yours.
Good evening. Good evening. Thank you, Sister Tussi, for your work. Your work is very important. When you look at the 11 African women, black women up in Cleveland who was murdered by Anthony Sowell, also known as the Cleveland Strangler, those sisters could have been here if more people would have focused on the work you're doing, because these are human beings. Those women was not looked at due to some of their economical status, due to being, you know, classified as what you would title a prostitute, sex worker, what have you. And also the 11 African, I'm sorry, the 13 black women who was raped down in Oklahoma by a police officer by the name of Daniel Holtzclaw. Just want to pay homage to those sisters down there who also was overlooked, and speaks volumes to your work being important. I had a couple questions I want to ask you. And I'll be brief due to the sake of time. The first question, I'm going to ask them all at one time, and if I need to repeat them, I will. The first question I want to ask you is, doing your research of putting together your book, did you come across any information in regards of AIDS? And I bring up AIDS because, as you know, AIDS and sex are connected, obviously, but moreover, it was an article in March 2019 issue of the New African Magazine titled, "We Deliberately Spread AIDS in South Africa." This article speaks about the South Africa's intelligence service spreading AIDS during the 1970s and the 1980s to combat Africans fighting for their freedom against apartheid. Just wanted to ask you, did you come across any information of that? I guess the second it's two more questions. The second question I have is, I understand that you are a part of some organizations, SWEAT and SWEEP, and I wanted to know, do y'all tackle the issues or address the issues with the United Nations peacekeepers having sex or taking advantage of children as sex workers in Haiti, the Congo, Sudan, Mozambique, all black parts or African parts of the world? And last but not least, this is a question I hope you don't take offense to. It's no negative connotation intent, just curiosity more than anything, because it's very seldom when I see when you click on a professional's page and you see the sister boldly wearing pink hair and embracing pink, is there a connection or is there a signature reason of you wearing the pink? I just out of curiosity, I had to ask that question. And those are all of the questions that I had, and I just want to conclude. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you so much for these questions, Brother Maurice. I really appreciate it. You know, going to your first question about AIDS, you know, during the course of my research, it wasn't a huge focus of the sex workers. I mean, of course, people regularly got tested, and I know that there were different kind of supports for people if they were HIV positive, but it just wasn't a primary concern for people. Perhaps maybe there's already, you know, by the time I went out to the field, it was, you know, there had already been a pretty developed, you know, structure for supporting people's needs around HIV, at least in Johannesburg area. So perhaps that's why it wasn't as much of a focus. But it's just not something I observed. I know there's been research that focuses on, you know, HIV contraction and public health questions for sex workers in South Africa, but it was just not the nature of my focus, since I was really kind of focused on policing and sex work. And, you know, the sex work advocacy group that you mentioned, SWEAT, you know, they haven't done, to my knowledge, you know, advocacy focus on like the UN peacekeepers situation, exploitation that's happened in, you know, in other countries. I'm not aware of that being as much of an issue in South Africa. I mean, perhaps it is, but I'm just not aware of it. And so there hasn't been a lot of focus on that. A lot of the advocacy in South Africa has been focused on decriminalization of sex work, the conditions of policing of sex work, and then, you know, providing support to sex workers' immediate needs, you know, some mutual aid. And so that's been the nature of the advocacy there, not to suggest that it might not progress to some of these other areas. And I think these are, you know, important issues to kind of focus on, the ways that, you know, vulnerable people can be subjected to exploitation, even from, you know, nonprofit groups and government officials who, you know, hold themselves out as representing human rights norms. And, you know, going to your last question, and I take no offense to that at all in terms of just how I present myself and, you know, why I made certain, you know, stylistic choices. And, it's pretty a simple answer. I don't know if it's, you know, entirely satisfying. And, you know, I just do it because I want to, and I feel like I can. You know, I think I've done enough and feel comfortable enough where I am in my career, and think that, you know, I can be who I am. And, you know, part of it is also to just be an example for other people, that you can be yourself and still be in these different environments and, you know, interact in these with people who, you know, have a lot of power and still be able to hold your own. You don't necessarily need to fit into one particular cookie cutter. And I have had so many, like, students and other people tell me how much they appreciate it, that now I feel kind of obligated to stay with it, just to have that counterexample for people, and, you know, just to show them, you know, different ways of being professional, because certainly the quality of work that I do and, you know, things that I've achieved, I'm certainly a professional, but, you know, I could also be expressive and creative at the same time.
Well, thank you, Sister. We next will go to Brother Moses. The mic is yours.
Thank you. And greetings, my sister. I was wondering if you had read Frederick Engels' Origin of the Family, Private Property in the State. That's because I'm a Marxist, and that's part of my ideological upbringing. And but anyway, they tell me that you know, this is the oldest trade on the earth. The oldest trade on the earth is the sexual trade or whatever. The hope for liberation would be that that it would be free from economic concerns. But that's to be pursued. But I don't know when it would be obtained in a different kind of society, just capitalist society where commodity, everything is made into a commodity, including the human beings and their labor power is made into a commodity, and so it's bought and sold on the marketplace, and it's just a product of capitalism ultimately. And that's why we need a revolution. And I don't know. I'm not sure where I'm going here. I appreciate your work and your insights into the, especially when you're talking about the police and the person that was pursuing the sex, as opposed to the sex worker being criminalized. I thought that was pretty interesting. Anyway, thank you for your work.
No, actually, thank you for your remarks. And you know what? It actually got me thinking, you know, and something I'm still thinking about and I don't have a clear answer for is that, you know, what society am I envisioning, right? Is it about just allowing people to use, you know, sex for labor? And I don't think that's it, right? Perhaps, you know, in some ways that's just, you know, going to your point, focusing so much on commodification, allowing people to commodify, is it more about this society where people's material needs are met and they can make the choices that they want to make, right? Not constrained choices. And I think, you know, that's kind of what I've been thinking about and envisioning and, you know, trying to conceptualize and be mindful on as I've been, you know, doing my work and thinking about what my future work would look like. And, you know, some of your remarks kind of highlight for me the ways that all the complexities, you know, that are encapsulated in this question of, like, what's the world that we want, right? We have this world right now. We have to engage in harm reduction right now, but also making sure that, you know, we stay imaginative and keep envisioning that other world.
And on that note, Professor India, we're going to take a quick long-term station break. And when we come back, we're going to have our final comments or thoughts to you, and then we're going to have you make your final thoughts about the book and how they can support it. To our listening viewers, this is Africa on the Move. You can catch us every Sunday from 7 to 9 p.m. and beyond. We're going to be in the seat, and we're going to take the heat. We may not give you what you want, but we will do our best to give you what you need. We'll be right back. This is Africa on the Move.
If you think of the Middle East in this modern time, you can't help but say the word Palestine. People there have lost their land. Some have lost their home. They live in other countries, their freedom almost gone. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love. Needs our love. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love. There seems to be no answer to give us the reason why people cannot live, so no one has to die. We've got to take a stand for freedom, take a stand for truth, take a stand for justice. That's what we've got to do, 'cause Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love. Needs our love. Palestine needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love. People of all countries, of every race and creed, we need a new beginning. Let us plant the seed. Plant the seed of love and let that love seed grow. Plant the seed for everyone so all the world will know that Palestine, needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love, needs our love. Palestine, Palestine needs her freedom, needs her freedom. Palestine needs our love.
That's right. The Palestinian people need their freedom and they need love, like all oppressed people, including our sex workers. We welcome you back to Africa Unruh. We're in our phase of doing our closing out for the night. But before we do that, we have a caller who have called in. We're going to take this caller. Caller, we can come to you right now. Your last four numbers are 1111. 1111. Your question or comment, caller. The mic is yours. 1111.
Hey, thanks so much for taking the call. I know you don't have much time. I just want to say that since all Homo sapiens are African and migrated, some, not all, to different parts of the world, the challenges that darker humans face in India, in America, in the Caribbean, South America, basically everywhere, stem from several sources. One is the Catholic Church and its papal bulls that put darker humans at the bottom. And, of course, the Anglican Church and Church of England, as it's sometimes called, and Islam also had a lot of slavery and anti-black and still do. But also we have economic systems that work against us, and police, CIA, major corporations, Facebook, Instagram, Reddit. So we have 360 24/7 challenges, but we don't have the infrastructure, the financial, the legal, the ethical, the accountants, the self-defense. And so in my lifetime, I don't see this ending. And I think the NFL, we see the players in the NFL, but we don't see much talk about Colin Kaepernick. We don't see much talk about, you know, Black Lives Matter. I think some groups get comfortable and then forget everyone else, but they look black, talk black, play sax, but aren't really about the cause. So not sure where us black folks are going to end up, but if we don't come together, it won't be a pretty sight. Thanks. I know your show is about to end. Thanks for taking the call.
Thank you, Carl, for your comments and allowing us to come to your home this evening. This is Africa Unruh. We're making our final transition. I want to ask each one of our panelists and analysts for today, 1 minute or less, to make a final statement to our guest, Professor, Law Professor, India Tusi. Your final thoughts to the professor, Brother Maurice.
Yes, I just want to salute Sister Tusi for her work and for her bravery to, you know, address this issue, and also to address capitalism, the root of these issues, to continue to struggle for our sisters involved in sex work and continue to be a voice for them. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brother Maurice. Next, we go to 1 minute less, Sister Eleanor, your statement to our sister.
Thank you so much, Sister Tutsi, for your work. And just want to thank you, and the issue that Brother Maurice brought up about AIDS in South Africa, it's a real crisis right now. And as when you enter as a tourist, you enter the hotels, other places, they're providing condoms and a lot of assistance. And good luck with your work with oppressed children and women. So often children are prostitutes, as was said by one of the analysts earlier. So continue to work with them, and may they be safe and liberated. Maybe you hope to see something like you see in the Netherlands.
I don't know. But the bottom line is, until the many organize to defeat the few, you'll see this type of oppression. Thank you. Thank you for your work.
Thank you, Sister Eleanor. Brother Moses, your final comments to that guest.
Well, you know, we're struggling for, at least I'm struggling for socialism, which is anti-capitalism. The profit-driven system of capitalism is only detrimental to the ultimate interest of the public. And we need a government that's dedicated to the people and actually serving the vast majority of the people, the working class. And until we have that kind of government, we're bound to see all kinds of problems continuing. And you know, but anyway, I was going to say about origin of the family private property in the state. You have this trade going on, and then you have class society developing around it, and it just compounds the enslavement of the people. Because everything's being sucked up. If nothing's trickling down, money is being sucked up, and the rich are getting richer, and the poor are getting poorer. Anyway, I'll leave it right there. Thank you.
Sorry for the delay. Brother Haki, you found the thoughts, too, I guess.
Yeah, I'd just like to say to the professor, you know, thanks for coming on, and her analysis was very insightful. We learned a great deal today, and reading her book, much to be gleaned from just reading her book. I think it's important that, you know, we recognize that her work is indispensable in terms of bringing about genuine humanity. One of the things is that there is this tendency among many, many people to believe that some people are better than others based upon material possessions. The bottom line is that nobody is more important than anyone else. And the mere fact that when we talk about sex workers underscores the need in terms of understanding that essentially we're talking about is human beings. There's no degree of human beings. They're only human beings. And her book sort of highlights that very, very important point. So having said that, Brother Africa, I simply say, you know, again, thank her for coming on and, you know, to vouch this information to the audience, because I'm sure the audience received a lot in terms of a more vivid understanding in terms of some of the problems, you know, confronting humanity.
Thank you, Haki. Brother Anthony, your final thoughts? For our guest today.
Certainly. Dr. Thusi, thank you for taking the time to appear on this program today. Your book and your views are very informative. And the solution to our problems is the permanent organization of the masses of working people, sex workers included. And we have to organize in order to defeat all forms of capitalist exploitation. And that is the ultimate solution to our problem.
Thank you, Anthony. And before we close out with the final words from our guest, Dr. Thusi, Professor Thusi, we want to again remind our listening audience that the book We Demand, The Full Disclosure and Dignification of All Slavery-Era Records by Bob Brown, Volume 1 and 2 from the Pan-African Roots Publishers. Please go to website www.a-aprp.gc.org if you'd like to purchase that book. The sucker nursery and closing out. We would like to remind all of our supporters and friends and people who have interest in seeing Cuba for themselves. Come and join us in the African Awareness Association as they take their annual Black History Education and Culture Travel Challenge to Cuba. They'll be visiting four areas, Guantanamo, San Diego, and Havana, which is the capital. It's from July 23rd to July 31st, leaving from Cancun, Mexico. They say be there, be square. For more information, you may contact 804-549-7492 or 202-714-9435 or go to that website, www.aaa.cubatours.com. Those are our announcements for tonight. We're going back to our guest, to our Professor Tusi. And we're going to ask you two quick things, Professor Tusi, then you can give us your final take on why and how you are seeking to impact the world as relates to reading and getting your book. So two quick questions I would like to actually lead on. You talk about the question, you use the term feminism. We know that throughout the world and throughout different cultures, whatever, there are different interpretations of feminism. I'd like to hear your feminism and talk just a little bit, too, about this question of you earlier. You talk about different class division in the social workers themselves. So you speak to those two issues and then give us a final pitch on how and why we should support your book. The mic is yours.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me tonight. Thank you, listeners, for joining in this conversation and the panelists for your insights and questions and comments. It's really helped me and informed me in my own thinking and where I want to go after this. But, you know, the book is about the policing of sex work. I'm hoping that people take away insights about how we use police generally in society and whether policing is an appropriate form of providing protection and preventing harm. I think in the book, I illustrate the harms that come from policing. And, you know, when I speak about feminism, what I'm really speaking about is empowering women, ensuring that women can feel empowered, can have their needs met, can, you know, operate in a place where they have real autonomy. And if that's what we're concerned with, right, if we want to ensure that women are empowered, relying on police, the state agent that has been sanctioned with using violence to maintain racial and gender hierarchies in capitalist societies, then all we can expect is for the police to also bring more violence and more harm. And in terms of the different classes of sex workers, when we're speaking about people who face marginalization because they're Black or because they're immigrant or they have disabilities, then they're especially vulnerable to police violence. And that's why I think it's really important for us to take a step back and reexamine whether policing and criminalization are the appropriate ways for preventing harm in society, for feminists to really reexamine whether criminalization is appropriate in this context. But, you know,
and,
thank you so much for having me.
And the question again, how can we reach out to get your book and maybe invite you to come to our communities?
Sure. So you can reach out to me on I2C. Again, that's I-T-H-U-S-I at indiana.edu. If you do a quick Google search for me, India Tusi, T-H-U-S-I, Indiana, you'll find my faculty webpage, and there you can find my description. And I focus on policing, criminalization, race, gender, sexuality, and, you know, issues that are, you know, all those individual issues, but also those issues at the different intersections and how they work together. But I'm really looking forward to hearing from more of you and, you know, continuing this conversation.
And on that note to our listening audience, like always, I'm Brother Africa. We was in the seat and we chose to take the heat. And we must give much praise and thanks to our special guest, Professor India Tusi, for coming forward and sharing some of her works as relates to her new upcoming book, Policing Bodies, Lost Sex Worker and Liar in Johannesburg. We'd like to let our sister know that anytime when she's doing something or have created any new works, we will always be here for her. So this is her station. This is the People Station. You can hear this program every Sunday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio. You can dial in to listen in or call in by dialing 323-679-0841. Any questions or comments, we encourage you to email us at africaonthemove2@gmail.com. Until next time, next week, like always, we're going to strive to go forward wherever, backwards never. We thank you for allowing us to come to your home this evening, and we will always speak truth to the powerless and the powerful. This has been Africa on the Move, and we leave you with some music inspiration for my brother Gil Scott Hearn. We live in the winter in America.
From the Indians, welcome the pilgrims, and to the buffaloes who once ruled the plains. Like the vultures circling beneath the dark clouds, looking for the rain, looking for the rain. Just like the cities that stagger on the coastline, and a nation that just can't stand much more. Like the forest buried beneath the highway, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter, winter in America. Yes, and all of the hills have been killed, sent away. Yeah, but the people know it's winter. Winter in America, and ain't nobody fighting, 'cause nobody knows what to say. Save your soul, Lord knows, from winter in America. The Constitution, a noble piece of paper, with free society, the struggle, but they died in vain. And now democracy is a ragtime on the corner, hoping for some rain. It looks like he's hoping, hoping for some rain. And I see the robins perched in barren treetops, watching last-ditch races marching across the floor. But just like the peace signs that vanished in our dreams, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter, winter in America, and all of the hillers have been killed or betrayed. Yeah, but the people know it's winter. Lord knows it's winter in America. Nobody knows what to say. Save your soul from winter in America. Sick.
Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. War is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and kiss here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Talk to me, so you can't.